Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
For much of the region, Sandy continues to be an immediate crisis, with homes being rebuilt and heat getting restored, as we talk about every day. But it's also a long-term wake-up call, and lots of big thinking is happening around what exactly Sandy means for our climate, our infrastructure, our future. Columbia University is tackling some of these questions with a university forum this coming Monday featuring faculty from the environmental, public health, engineering, and public affairs departments. Two of the participants join us now. Benjamin Orlov is an anthropologist at the Center for Research on Environmental Decisions, studying climate change and preparedness and how we respond to danger. And Radley Horton is a research scientist at the Center for Climate Systems Research at Columbia. He has also served on panels sponsored by the city looking into the effects of climate change. Professor Orlov, Dr. Horton, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And listeners, we're getting a preview of Monday's event now, but if you want to watch the full thing, it'll be streamed online. There's a link on our site. And we'll open the phones as well with a climate scientist and a disaster expert here. So if you have any questions about rising sea levels and how we deal with them or related things, give us a call, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And let's start by talking a little bit about how we prepared for Sandy before we get to future steps. Professor Orlov, do you think people were aware of how significant a storm it would be? It was certainly the patter on the weather, you know, the weather forecast for the several days in advance.
We've been following that because we actually conducted surveys from Friday to the Monday before the storm hit, did telephone surveys from Virginia, Delaware, Maryland, and New Jersey to see what people thought. And a lot of them kind of knew there was going to be high winds, but they were confused about whether it was a hurricane. And even the people who knew that there was high winds were coming really didn't anticipate that the power would go out. They didn't anticipate the storm surge.
I wonder if the if when we think about Sandy, we should think about the beginning of something that's a new era, as a lot of folks are saying, or whether something got forgotten from those pre-Sandy weather forecasts. Because I know we were saying it over and over again, and we talked to a Columbia University climate scientist, in fact, Dr. Sobel, who was saying that this is going to be a very unusual event because not only was the hurricane coming up the eastern seaboard, you also had this other more traditional weather system coming from the west, and it was the fact that they collided right in the New York area that was so unusual. So I wonder what you think about that.
So I think, yes, there was this unusual combination of two storms, but I think we see the presence of sea level rise, certainly. We see the ocean is higher than it was when they started recording its level in the late 1800s, and so the fact that the waters were higher was due not just to the storm, but to sea level rise, and that's a growing factor, as we know.
Dr. Horton, did you want to get in on that?
Yeah, thanks. So sea levels have risen about a foot in the New York region since 1900. We expect them to rise, by conservative estimates, approximately 2 feet over the next century. Our research for New York City suggests that just by virtue of those conservative increases in sea level, that sort of raising of the floor, coastal flooding events that currently happen once every 10 years might happen roughly 3 times as often, even if storms themselves don't get any stronger. So clearly, there's a lot of vulnerable infrastructure and people at risk. But then it's also interesting, as I think you are, if you want to get into that to some extent, we can talk about the storm itself, its track, and its intensity, and whether, as the climate changes, storms themselves might change, separate from this issue of average sea level and mm-hmm. the sort of floor of a basketball court rising in a way.
Do you think that
if you don't raise the rims, you're going to get more dunks, more coastal flooding?
Do you think they will change the nature of storms?
Yeah, I think that the sea level rise case is a home run. In terms of the nature of the storms, there's compelling research suggesting that as the ocean warms, we're going to see an increase in the most intense hurricanes. Hurricanes do get their energy from the warm ocean surface. We know that this past couple months have had water temperatures 3 to 5 degrees above normal. That helped provide extra energy to this storm. You could actually see it on the satellite maps. What's tricky is to attribute this year's sea surface temperatures to climate change. It's easy to say that we expect more warm ocean temperatures in the future. It's a little hard to attribute this year. And then the more speculative research relates to this issue of the track. And specifically, there's some early research, I would say, suggesting that as sea ice disappears in the Arctic, we've seen a loss of about 70% of the volume of sea ice in the Arctic in fall. It may impact the steering patterns in the atmosphere, the jet stream, this current of air that blows from west to east, in a way that just like as a river becomes weaker, when the jet stream weakens, as you get a lot of warming in the Arctic as the ice melts, we may get a more meandering pattern to the jet stream, more dips in a way that could allow storms to take this unusual track instead of a strong current of air west to east that normally pushes storms towards the east as they get as far north as, say, New Jersey. What we saw with this storm was a very unusual turn to the west that was associated with a kink in that jet stream. This is one storm. We've only had a few years of these dramatic decreases in sea ice, but it's a big research area as to whether we might see more of these meanders, more storms, and more tracks of storms turning to the west in the future.
And Dr. Orlov, I wonder if that relates to your study that found people were thinking more about the path of the storm from what they were hearing in the media, rather than the ripple effect, so to speak, of higher sea levels and the storm surge. Is that a failure of government, a failure of public education, a failure of the Weather Channel? What?
Well, it's easy to point fingers and blame. I think we do need to do greater preparedness. We've made big progress in hurricanes over previous decades, but we still have a long way to go. People are really used to hearing the H word, I started calling it, the hurricane word, and the National Weather Service decided that Sandy really wasn't quite a hurricane, and that may have played one element in the low level of preparation, but there are a lot of other factors. We found that of the people who live within one block of the water in our sample, our random sample picked up some people very close. Listen, people who live within a block of the water, less than a third of them had flood insurance, so we really need to rethink our flood insurance program.
We're talking about lessons from Sandy with Radley Horton and Benjamin Orlov from Columbia University, 212-433-WNYC. And Kylie in Montclair, you're on the air. Hello, Kylie.
Hi. I had a question. Senator Sweeney has made a comment a couple of times that in New Jersey, we should look at buying out the houses of people who live close to where it constantly floods and just say to these people that this land is no longer good to live on, I guess, and kind of let the water live there since the water seems to want to live there. I just wanted to know what your guest had to say about that kind of approach. I mean, are we setting ourselves up for failure by continually letting people live in places where they really just, it's not safe to live because there's constant water?
It's a really central question going forward. I'm so glad you raised it. Dr. Horton, do you want to start with that?
Sure. I think given the extent of our vulnerability, which I think we as a society understand now, not just in New York and New Jersey, but nationally, we're going to need a suite of strategies. We're going to need everybody at the table as we consider a range of innovative solutions. In some locations, managed retreat is absolutely going to be part of the discussion. There are certain areas where it's impossible to build a large engineering structure like a seagate. There are areas that are already being flooded consistently today. It may be as we move forward this century that the dangers and the impacts on property values, for example, make it necessary to retreat from some areas. But we need a suite of strategies. There are individual things that can be done today to make certain types of structures be able to sort of passively have some water, get some key electrical equipment, backup systems to the higher floors, exciting designs of new buildings where there can be some passive flooding, green solutions where we restore wetlands along the coast and other ways to sort of catch rainwater. And in some areas, it's going to be a discussion of larger and more ambitious engineering solutions as well. I think we're going to need a suite of strategies, and one of them is going to be retreat in some places of the type that the caller was describing.
That's a very loaded term that you slipped in there, managed retreat, strategic retreat. So people are going to think about their homes and their, you know, trips to their summers at the beach and all of these things in these terms, and I guess those are very difficult decisions.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, as I say, it's going to be different solutions in different places. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, when we look at the amounts of sea level rise that we expect, when we look at the implications on insurance, for example, I think it's increasingly going to become part of the dialogue. And they're going to be winners and losers. So it's really important that everybody be at the table.
Terry in Garden City, you're on WNYC. Hi, Terry.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. My question is, with all these storms, Irene last year and now this one, how high up are we going to have to build up our barrier beaches and roadways like Ocean Parkway and other areas? Are we, how much the sea levels are going to rise, are we going to have to go up 5 feet, 10 feet, even more? What would we have to do to protect ourselves with these barrier beaches?
Professor Orlov, are you in this area?
Yes, I am, and I think as Ravi says, it's really a question that involves getting everyone together at the table. People are faced with a big threat, and they'd love to know that there's one solution and forevermore they're safe. But there are going to be a lot of decisions that have to be made together about what kind of interruptions we can tolerate in our transportation service, what risk of flooding we can tolerate in our homes, and to really think about prioritizing. These are going to be public expenditures. These are going to be private expenditures on the part of homeowners. Insurance companies are going to have to join in. So it's going to take a lot of people working together to find those solutions. And it won't be the single one solution for the whole region. It will be a whole mix of different solutions. I realize that sounds kind of general, but it does mean that we're going to all have to join in to think this through.
And Terry, thank you for your call. Another whole area to evaluate is evacuations. In the immediate aftermath of the storm, it seemed like Mayor Bloomberg got a fair amount of praise for having reworked New York's evacuation plan. But here's Huffington Post reporter John Rudolph on this program earlier this week.
We have some quotes by Mayor Bloomberg that, I mean, he was completely off the mark. You know, he shifted right before the storm hit on Sunday. The rhetoric shifted dramatically, said everybody needs to get out. But if you know, read those statements that he made on Saturday night.
And you have quotes from people who are in the affected areas who said they were listening to those statements. And one day he was saying it's not going to be bad as Irene, which wasn't bad at all. And the next day he was saying, get the heck out. They heard those messages.
So that was John Rudolph from Huffington Post with guest host Mike Pesca, who was filling in on Tuesday when I was out. So, Professor Orlov, how do you evaluate the city's evacuation plans?
Well, I think the city did a better job than many. You just have to look at the other side of the Hudson to see that it was even more of a mess in Hoboken, where people were told only to evacuate from basements and first floors. It's we also see that the communication of evacuation orders is really very difficult. From our surveys, which we did with 540 people, we found that less than half the people who were in evacuation zones even knew they were in evacuation zones. And we also found that people didn't develop evacuation plans. So the people who knew that they might have to evacuate just didn't really think, how am I going to get to someplace safe? So there's both the question of issuing the forecast, of coordinating the evacuation orders, and of getting people prepared. It's easy to point fingers and blame it one or another, but you need to make sure that people get the story early.
Do you think authorities should have forcibly removed those who didn't evacuate voluntarily from Zone A?
A forcible evacuation just doesn't work. You need to get too many people out too quickly. You really need to get people to understand that they're part of the solution and to have them go voluntarily. You couldn't get the hundreds or thousands of people you'd need to go door-to-door and haul people out.
Do either of you see Hurricane Sandy as a tipping point in terms of climate change? And is it up to the media or politicians or another group to keep it on the front burner? Dr. Horton?
I think this could be a tipping point. It's hard to say exactly when a tipping point comes, but when it does come, it's characterized by a rapid change in behavior. And I think if not now, we may see that soon. I mean, are we approaching a point where long-term climate hazards, present hazards that we may not have fully understood, and changes, increasing risk in some cases of heat waves, coastal storm surge flooding in the future, are going to have an impact on everything from, you know, long-term investments in infrastructure to a lot of sort of basic private sector decisions. And you mentioned the media specifically. It's interesting to think about as sea levels rise, is it going to be an extreme storm like Sandy that sort of provides that tipping point, a type of storm where some people can say, well, that could have happened anyway, because in a sense that's true. We think this is a one and couple hundred year event? Or is it going to be the more routine, sort of mundane types of flooding, not associated with a big storm, that we're hearing more and more about in places like Norfolk, Virginia, parts of the Florida coastline? It may be those stories about the routine nuisance flooding happening more frequently. If there's a point where the media starts to pick up those stories more and more, you begin to wonder whether it could have a momentum of its own and get people thinking about some of the financial and other implications of living in vulnerable areas.
Before you both go, there's so much discussion of what didn't go well during Sandy, which obviously is appropriate to do after any disaster where there was a lot of destruction. What went well during Sandy? Anything you would put at the top of your list? Either of you, Professor Orlov, want to start on that?
Yes, I think there, you know, when we see how this is very sad to talk about, are the fatalities, and when you see how those were concentrated in a few neighborhoods, you can see that there are other neighborhoods that had higher levels of preparedness, stronger networks among neighbors and relatives who took care of each other. And so I think we can be fortunate that the deaths weren't closer to Katrina levels.
Half the people who died in New York City died on Staten Island, in I think some fairly tight-knit communities. Do you think there are reasons? I don't know if you investigated the deaths. And, of course, people die in hurricanes in all kinds of ways, but a number of predictable ways, right? They drown, they get hit by trees, they're electrocuted by coming in contact with water or power lines after they've come down. They die from carbon monoxide poisoning, from improper generator use. I don't know if I've hit on all the biggest categories, but are there specific lessons, Dr. Orlov, to follow up on what you just said, to prevent fatalities?
Yes, I think you made an excellent point about the tight-knit neighborhoods. I think those are a resource that we still can use. So it's a question of taking those tight links and making that a culture of preparedness, getting a lot of people who, rather than saying we all can tough it out here, get together to say we can keep an eye on the old person down the block living alone who needs someone to knock on his door.
And what went well in your view, and we'll end on that, Dr. Horton?
I think that New York City's leadership role in addressing this issue going back to 2008, the MTA, if we look at the fact that there were plans in place for evacuation, a planned way to shut down the subway system several hours in advance so you could both protect the rolling stock, the cars, but more importantly, help keep people off the streets by making the transportation system not in place. There's also very specific adaptation strategies that the city has already undergone. You've seen the MTA elevating the entrances to some subway stations, and ventilation grates. They couldn't help with a storm. They couldn't solve the issues associated with an enormous surge of this size, but they were steps in the right direction, just like revitalization of wetlands that we've seen along the coast are steps in the right direction, and fast-tracking of research into large-scale engineering solutions that's underway as well, steps towards reducing our vulnerability that are already underway.
And just one other thing on the death toll. 110 or so people died along the eastern seaboard from Sandy. 1,800 deaths were attributed to Katrina. Was that because of better preparation and better infrastructure, or just the nature of the storm, was more deadly in Katrina's case? Have either of you looked into that comparison? Because it's really drastic.
I have a colleague here at Columbia, John Mutter, who's done a lot of research on Katrina. And I think it's really both. And New Orleans had neglected infrastructure, and it's the failure of the infrastructure that contributed to the drowning. But the evacuation was very poorly prepared, and there was just really a collective lack of attention. The sorts of things that Radley mentioned about New York City preparing were just so absent in New Orleans.
Radley Horton is a research scientist at the Center for Climate Systems Research at Columbia University. And Benjamin Orlov is an anthropologist at the Center for Research on Environmental Decisions at Columbia. There will be a forum at Columbia University on Monday featuring various faculty from the Environmental, Public Health, Engineering, and Public Affairs departments. You can get more information on our site at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show. We'll also place a link to the conference itself, which will be available online at that time. Thank you both very much for having this conversation.
Thank you.
Brian Lehr at WNYC, coming up next to Afghanistan and Mali and beyond, Kimberly Martin with her new book about how warlords rule in failed states and the national security implications for the United States. Stay tuned.